Hi, friends. Thank you for joining us for this week's edition of Professors in Rooms Getting Coffee. Before we get started, I wanted to let you know that we recorded this week's episode before we learned about the killing of George Floyd. We often talk about issues of culture, race, and society, so we plan to be talking about this next week. I would encourage you to listen to our sister podcast, Postulating Solutions with Preachers, on Monday, June 1st, as Pastor John P. Perkins and Pastor Matthew J. Watts talk with Minneapolis Pastor Luke Swanson about George's death and race relations. Today, we talk with Mike Piccinato, who lives in Berlin. We're glad you're with us for episode 9 of Professors in Rooms Getting Coffee. So what's been a highlight for you this week?
Yeah, so this might sound odd, but I've been working behind a desk for so long now that every now and then when I have a chance to do manual labor, it feels really good.
Yeah.
It was the opposite for me for a while, where I'd work construction for a couple summers and some pretty intense construction. And we'd get up at 7 a.m. and probably finish around 7 p.m. some days. And I did not look forward to the next day. You know, your body is just completely spent. But
right, that makes sense.
My in-law's cabin needed some work done on it. And we came up here and have been doing some things. And I mean, I've been tired every day, but it's been refreshing in some ways, kind of getting the body moving and doing manual labor. And then I noticed, you ever notice this, that the food always tastes better after you've been doing hard physical work. So like a common sandwich, which normally would be nothing to write home about, is all of a sudden just tastes, you know, magnificent. So so the manual labor was a highlight for me, believe it or not.
Nice. That's great.
How about for you?
So this week, a friend told us about an online art festival.
Oh, cool.
So we decided to participate. So Jenny and the kids did some art things, and Rosemary did a painting for it. And then there was also this Lego video competition.
So do you have to make your own Lego video? Kind of like a Lego movie?
So you make your own Lego video. So about a month ago, I had challenged the kids to do that. I was like, hey, why don't you guys try this, doing a stop motion kind of thing. And so they had started working on it. So then last week we found out about this and we're like, oh, let's do one. So we started over and did a new one. Sunday was the big announcement of kind of the finale of the art fest. And so we were all sitting in the living room, and the kids were like super nervous. They're like, are we gonna win? Because there was $100 Lego gift certificate. Like the stakes are high. And we're sitting there, and they go through and they say, well, first runner up, you know, second runner up. There were only maybe 7 videos in the thing. And so we're like, okay, well, we weren't either of those, you know, maybe. And they announced the video by playing the video. And as soon as we heard the intro music, we knew it was ours. And there was just this eruption in the living room, like all 5 of us. I don't remember any time where all 5 of us have been that celebratory at the same time ever.
That's
and the dog
cool.
too. So 6 of us, all 6 of us. Just like, yeah. So that was really exciting. It's just this really short, you know, 30-second video. It was a lot of fun to make. And then it was a lot of fun to win.
So I got
to
see that video. How can I get a hold of it?
Yeah. I'll put a link in the show notes.
Oh, that's great. Perfect. So how about a low light for you?
So a low light for me. Okay. So I guess this low light is maybe a couple weeks old, but it's relevant. Okay. First though, I was supposed to get a shipment of coffee on Saturday and it didn't come.
Oh no.
And I checked the postal service website and it said, it is in our system. Like it's making its way through the system. It doesn't say where it is. I have no idea what state it's in.
Which is so weird because usually they give you the location information.
And somewhere. I had that before and then that went away. So I don't know what that means. Anyway, but I think the low light for me is, so I'd revised a book, my Transitions Across Cultures book. Mm-hmm. And we decided way back in like, I don't know, November or something, we're going to release it in May. And so we had it all set to release in May. And then, you know, I think we got the final work done on it, maybe in January, you know, and then the idea is, you know, to have a few months of sending out reader copies and, mm-hmm. you know, trying to get some buzz around it. And then with the whole COVID thing, we just didn't do any of that, but we had already set the release date and we just kind of let it go. And I think it was just disappointing because we were looking forward, I guess, to really promoting the book and kind of trying to get some movement around it, and then just didn't. And it's like you can't go back and release it.
Re-release it.
I mean, you can, I guess. I mean, it's because this is a revised copy of a book I had already released, right? But
that's a bummer.
So that's just been kind of sad.
Yeah, especially when it's kind of circumstantial like that, when some of the things just cause these hiccups that you didn't necessarily anticipate.
Right. The best laid plans, right?
Yeah, and it wasn't anything like you had done, you know, it's just the way that it kind of fell that way.
Yeah. How about you? What's a little late been?
Well, for me, we were on our way up to, you know, to my in-law's cabin, and in the car, we stopped actually to get some gas outside of Duluth, and the car broke down.
No.
So we turned the car off, you know, to fill up, and then we tried to turn it back on, and nothing was happening.
Is this the van?
This is the van, yeah. And I mean, it was packed to the brim, absolutely packed.
That's the worst.
Yeah, and I'm not inept when it comes to cars, but I'm no magician either. So I'm tinkering around with it, and there's a gentleman kind of who sees me doing this, and he's kind of offering a few suggestions, and finally we just decide, well, let's just try to jump it. So you know, we jumped it, and the thing actually eventually fired up. So we pieced together the fact that it was the battery, which is great because the battery is
about that's like the easiest fix, right?
one of the easiest things to fix. So we got that thing moving, and we're able to stop at one of the car shops and get a battery for it and everything. But you know, there's that moment where you're sitting there at the gas station, and we're still an hour and a half from our destination, thinking, oh great, what's this gonna look like now?
And then you know, the thought of unpacking everything.
Exactly. And so there's that tension there of like, you know, are we gonna have to get a hotel, or you know, how are we gonna get out of this mess? And then there's kind of the excitement of, oh, it's only a battery, so
right.
So it was fine. And this isn't the first time this has happened. This also leads to my insight though for the week in some ways, which is I came to this realization. I was talking with a buddy the other day that you know, my wife, her car broke down a few years ago, and we got her a decently nice used car. Mm-hmm. But for myself, I don't think I've ever owned a vehicle that's cost more than $2,000
in
my
whole life.
I've driven these beaters, you know, that are just completely, you know, beat up and have all these problems, and I've gotten by just fine with them. But I feel like I'm getting a stage of my life where I'm not a lavish person. I won't just buy a nice car because I need a nice car or anything like that. But I've gotten this point in my life where I'm like, I'm sick and tired of having to fix cars all the time. Like it's just, it's not any fun. So my insight is, you know, maybe it's time to think about potentially having a vehicle that will run without breaking down.
You know, I made the switch a couple of years ago, and it's really nice. I mean, like, and I'm not like doing these like super fancy cars. My current car situation is super weird, but like, it's so nice to not like, and I felt like I was spending as much repairing cars, you know, over the course of having a car. So I don't know.
That's exactly it. Yeah. And the funny part of it all is I inherited my in-law's van when my father-in-law passed away, and I've been driving that thing, you know, ever since. You know, you've seen it, the big red van. And and I realize now I am a van guy, man. I love vans. And it just shows, you know, I've got no, you know, sense of needing to look cool in me when it comes to any of this stuff, because I love the fact that I can take those seats out and pack a ton of stuff in there. And I also like, you know, now that we've got two kids, I like having more space and more room to haul stuff around in, even when it comes to the family. So I don't know what's going to happen. I don't have any big plans or anything, any big purchases in mind, but I'm kind of just thinking, you know, I don't know how many more of these like even little fixes I want to do on this vehicle. And maybe it's time to look at least getting something that will last and not break down for a little while.
Yeah. That is funny. I've had that kind of thing even with clothes, where I've realized it's worth sometimes buying like one step up, because I have to replace them so much less frequently.
Oh yeah.
And it actually ends up costing less, but you know, I don't know.
How about for you, an insight?
An insight for me, I've been thinking about, okay, so there's this role that Jenny and I are applying for, and part of it is going through a psych eval. And there's this thing where you have to talk about your history, like growing up and all this kind of stuff. And you know, I mean, it feels a little bit personal. It's very personal, right? It's like, you know, did you have any issues, you know, as a kid, that kind of thing. And this is not the assessments, those are later, but just the process of going through and thinking about my childhood. I just realized, like, I experienced a lot of really hard things as a kid. And I think I didn't realize it because there were enough good things that, And it felt like a lot of the bad things were near me, not necessarily me. For example, at one point, so my dad was in the Navy, and at one point we were living in Japan, and the aircraft carrier that my dad was serving on had a fire on it. And the neighbor a couple houses down was in the fire. And I can't remember if he died or if he was injured. A couple of people did die in that fire. Like, that's really, I mean, that affects you, right? Yeah. Like, knowing like how quickly life can change and the uncertainty of it. And even that, as that happened, that my dad was on that same ship, you know, that had happened on, or as we were getting ready to leave LA, we were supposed to go to Disneyland, but the LA riot happened, the Rodney King riots.
Oh, really?
And so we didn't get to go. And I, you know, just a lot of little things like that, and realizing like, I think I've been more affected by that kind of stuff than I have ever stopped to notice. And so writing it all down in one place, you know, like, yeah, I put it in maybe 3 or 4 paragraphs, and it's like, oh, there's a lot of that kind of, like, I don't know. It's just something I hadn't really thought about all at one time before.
So wait, you were in LA during the Rodney King riots?
No, we were in San Diego, and we were supposed to go. Yeah. So, but I mean, it was local news for us, course. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. That's, yeah. It's hard, isn't it? Sometimes I have to reflect back on those experiences, because I feel like more often than not, it's not necessarily all roses, you know, rose colored glasses, but that some of the more painful moments can become more illuminated from hindsight than the good moments. I don't know why that is, but I feel like, you know, in the moment, sometimes it's actually easier to feel some of the goodness and to miss some of the pain. And then in hindsight, sometimes that pain becomes more illuminated. It's interesting. I don't know why it always, you know, maybe it doesn't always work that way, but I don't know why it can work that way.
I think I struggle sometimes to go back and really remember good moments. And it's actually, it's a fun activity to like try to put yourself back into like a really good moment. Like, and I had some really good moments too as a kid. Sure. Like, I remember one of my favorite was eating breakfast with an orangutan in Singapore. Wow. So yeah, my sister and I got to eat breakfast with this orangutan.
That's cool.
So,
man, I had this thought this week, you know, we talked a couple of weeks ago, or I'd mentioned something about, you know, remembering what God had done in the past for us, you know, as a way to kind of navigate anxieties. And I was just thinking about how the people of Israel had all these things in place for memory, to remember what God had done. And I remember a mentor of mine several years ago saying something like, find yourself a tangible object that can represent something God's done in your life. And I never really took that to heart much, but I was just thinking about how...
But that's like the idea of an Ebenezer, right?
It's exactly it. Yeah, that's exactly what that is. And that, where that comes from. And what I was thinking was, man, I haven't spent much time like compiling my own list. Like, if I were a psalmist, and I'm not, but if I were, and I were to kind of list off, man, God, you were faithful here. You were faithful here. I can tend to look at the moments where I'm like, those were complicated moments where it's difficult for me to see how God was navigating the situation in my life. What I don't tend to do is to remember, oh, actually, there are these pretty incredible moments where God was so faithful, and I haven't even compiled a list of those things. And so I just started to reflect in my mind, like over the last few years, like, what are some of those things? And it was really encouraging.
That's really fun.
Yeah. And I probably could go even deeper and just go even further back, you know, into my own personal history. But it's trying to maybe balance out those aspects where we can have painful memories of the past, but then it's also helpful to maybe remember. And this isn't a critique of anything you said. It's more of just my own processing of, man, I do need to remember those times where I'm like, man, God really came through there.
Yeah. And to let both of those really be true.
For sure. Yeah. And the tendency is to maybe go so strong in one direction or the other, right? To just think of, oh, God is so faithful. And then almost to not even acknowledge the moments that are more complex than that and more painful, or to go in the other direction where all we feel is the pain and, God, where were you?
Right.
And it's like, well, hold on a minute. What about all those times where, and the other thing is that, you know, since a lot of my painful memories is driven by anxiety, it's like once the anxiety is over and God has been faithful, it's like, I'm just ready to move on. So I don't really even spend time reflecting back going, oh yeah, God was actually pretty faithful in that moment. And I mean, I don't know. I feel like I could use a lot more of those thoughts.
Hey, you know what?
I'm guessing we have a guest with us today.
We do. We'll be right back in a moment with Mike Piccinato. So I'm really excited to have with us today Mike Piccinato, who lives in Berlin and he pastored in the U.S. for 16 years, six as a youth pastor, 10 as a lead pastor in a congregation in central Minnesota. In 2012, he and his family moved to Berlin, Germany, where they work with the Christian Missionary Alliance planting churches. Their first 5 years, they learned German, assisted an existing church plant, and helped them by leading a ministry center, which developed into a gallery, which is a really fun project, if you ever get to ask him about that. And then in 2018, they returned to Berlin after a year of home assignment and started leading a team of two projects, an Arab project reaching out to Arabic-speaking immigrants and a German project to establish a German-speaking network of house churches. So Mike, really glad to have you with us today.
Thanks. Great to be here.
So I've been watching on Facebook a little bit, you know, kind of seeing things that you and other people on your team have posted about, you know, what has the whole coronavirus situation been like for you? But what has the lockdown been like for you and for Berlin in general?
Berlin locked down pretty early in the whole lockdown scenario, and they had a plan, and they kind of followed the plan really well. I think one of the things that I've really enjoyed about being here is that they've communicated really, really well from the beginning that this was not a long-term removal of freedoms, that there was no intent to take away people's rights or freedoms, that this was about protection, that this was about solidarity, this was about protecting the weakest of people. And then pretty quickly, they started doing daily press conferences. And then the Robert Koch Institute started doing weekly press conferences with updated numbers and started to communicate what those numbers meant. And they're a non-decision-making organization, so they're just purely scientific and informal.
Oh, interesting.
They make the decisions, but they were just very publicly communicating, this is what we're at, where we're at.
Gotcha.
With recommendations, but with no decision-making power. And so pretty early, they started talking about the reproduction rate of the disease and saying, hey, we need to get this, with the amount of people infected now, we need to get this down below one so that each person passes it on to less than one person. Mm. And once we see that happen, then we can start relaxing some of the...
So there's a really obvious target that you're moving toward then?
Yeah. So there were two numbers that they were really aiming for. At first, all the talk was about how quickly is the disease doubling. And then they quickly realized, hey, that's really more difficult to measure. So how about we just talk about this reproduction rate, this infections rate of the disease. And so as soon as they started to get that under control, then they started having biweekly meetings of Berlin government officials and German government officials to say, when can we start to relax standards? So as those numbers came down, then they started to relax standards. And originally the plan was, we'll do it every 2 weeks. So we'll see... 2 weeks from now, we'll see what the result was from letting people get back together.
Rates.
So then they started happening more weekly. And so they've just made step-by-step slow reintegrations into normal life.
Germany has a federal system, right?
Yes, parliamentary, right. So they have a federal government with then individual states as well. Berlin is a city state, one of three city states, and then they have other individual states throughout the country.
Has the decision-making been happening more at the state level or at the federal level?
Originally, there was a lot happening at the federal level, and then they decided to release some of those more individual decisions to the state level. So there was a federal lockdown, and then now each state has been making more individual decisions, but that's been a more recent development. Originally, it was even, hey, there were biweekly Zoom calls with government leaders, the presidents of each state, the governors in the American system, with Angela Merkel, the Bundeskanzler, and it's hard to go from English to German on some of those terms. But then, they would do the biweekly calls with her then to kind of talk about what do we do on a national level, and then when do we kick things out to a state level. So they also came up with the system, hey, we'll let each state make their own decisions with certain pre-qualifying rules. Once the infections rate grows to be 50 per 100,000 people, then there's a lockdown in that state again. But other than that, people can begin to make their own rules.
Gotcha.
And Mike, Stephen and I in the podcast in previous episodes have reflected a little bit on how polarizing the conversation about COVID has been within the US. Mm-hmm. Have you noticed any major differences in your context in Berlin in terms of how some of the conversations are being navigated there compared to the US?
I think the level of communication from medical professionals, very open, clear, number-based, rational conversations with numbers and targets that everyone can work for, and a real focus on solidarity and the protection of the least of these, has been a different focus than I've picked up. And I'm really far away from the US, so like my biggest insight usually is through what I pick up on Facebook. Mm. And that's not always a great insight into culture. Mm. And so it's just, you know, somebody's 10-second rant or reply to somebody else's rant is what I feel like a lot of time I'm catching. But it's been a lot more focused on, hey, what can we do together? I've sensed here. And so now everybody's celebrating freedom and increased motion and movement and the ability to do more things, more because we've worked really hard at following the rules. And so we've brought the number down. And so now we can begin to enjoy freedoms as long as we can keep that number down, as opposed to what I've picked up on or seem to pick up on is that there's been a lot of our freedoms have been taken away. And so we need to exercise personal liberty. So here's more of a solidarity conversation than a liberty conversation.
I mean, it's just interesting as you were talking about it, it sounds like part of the communication is not only being numbers based, but it sounds like there's a fairly clear ethic being communicated as well. Is that right?
Yeah, it's interesting, right? Because Germany is very much in your post-Christian, post-modern, post-communism here where we live in former East Germany mindset. So the conversation isn't necessarily about Christian values. It's not about what would Jesus do in this situation. But there is very much a what is ethical and what is fair and how do we make decisions that are for the betterment of us as a culture and a society? What is best for all of us? It's a really interesting conversation to see take place here. Even from things like, I think, Stephen, you forwarded me an article about... Did you guys hear that? Yeah. Over their trash. Oh, recycling at its finest. Sounds like they must have just picked up glass today and somebody had a bunch saved up in their house. And so yeah, but I think even the idea of what do we do with the antibody tests? And is it ethical to begin to tell some people you've already had the disease so you can go out? And to tell other people you haven't been infected yet, so you need to stay in. And the fact that these medical decisions were going to be made by an ethics board, not just by what's pragmatic and how do we get everybody back the fastest. So those are just interesting conversations to see take place.
I mean, that's a fascinating conversation because what I had heard here was that antibody tests were being rolled out without even making sure that they necessarily worked. Like there was this huge false indication rate. Mm-hmm. And I don't know what value differences are driving those differences in approaches, but it's really interesting that it sounds like the question there is this good for society? Is this good for individual people? I mean, it feels like it's rooted very much in kind of a classical liberalism, you know, the individual liberty being very much at the core, but then also the sense that you can't achieve individual liberty without working together toward that. Does that seem right? Or
I mean, it's so complex when you start looking at European culture because you have so many layers to it, especially where we are here in East Berlin, because you can go back to certainly the time of kings and serfs where the government had a certain responsibility for the people. I actually have a friend who's descended from an Austrian royalty and actually is some low-level duke. And so talking with him about the approach to ruling, you know, he has some views that would never fly in American culture. But the idea of a responsibility given by God to the government to care for all of the people in the government is really fascinating to dialogue with him about, because the people have a dependency on the leadership to care for them. And the leadership sees that responsibility as something that God has given to them to enact. And somehow that's embedded in culture here in a way that's very different than the American mindset, where we very much in America have a history based on fighting for our freedoms from tyrannical governments, but that gives us often a little bit more of a Lone Ranger or cowboy approach to how we handle our own personal freedoms. And so when you then take that and you run it through a very late independence movement in Germany in the late 1800s, before they really had independent government, and then even then a parliamentary system with the king, just a very small non-king time frame after World War I, before Hitler and World War II, and then the time since then, and then communism here in former East Germany. And so there's just a different relationship between people and each other, and how do we care for each other, and what is the role of government? And so it's hard for me sometimes to really say, with my limited time here, this is exactly why German people tick the way they tick. Mm-hmm. But there are a lot more conversations about solidarity here and how do we do it together and the government, in a sense of how do we provide rules and working space and help to businesses and help to individuals. That doesn't seem like such a fight. It seems a little more like people working together. But time will tell.
Right.
You know, we're hitting recession here as well. And so time will tell.
Yeah, I saw that just this week in the news, right? That the first quarter was actually in recession in Germany.
Yeah.
And then expecting that it'll be worse in the second quarter.
Which is to be expected. You can't shut down businesses for so long without there being some kind of recession. I think it's just how do we interact with each other and with governments about that.
I'm really interested in what you're pointing out here, just about the emphasis in the U.S. on liberty and on personal liberties. You know, something I've noticed kind of anecdotally here in the U.S. is that there's been responses from folks and even some Christian folks that I know of who are really upset about like Costco requiring people to wear masks. And the thing that I've heard, and this is, I'm sure, not everyone's sentiment, but the thing that I've heard is, well, you know, why do I have to do that? That's an infringement upon my personal liberty. And there's even Christian folks who are saying this. And I don't want to be dismissive because there may well be some of our listeners who have some of the sentiments. But what I find interesting is that are there moments I wonder whether this emphasis on personal liberty actually clashes with what Christians believe about the gospel. And I'm not suggesting maybe that Germany has it right and that America has it wrong, but some of the things you're mentioning about personal liberty versus, how did you put it?
Solidarity.
Solidarity is fascinating to me because a verse that kind of popped in my mind, a passage, was the section in Philippians 2 about Jesus having taken on the form of a servant, having given up his own rights and his own liberties in many ways for the sake of us and for others. And I couldn't help but think, you know,
not just in many ways, right?
Not like just in many ways, in every way.
Like yes. To the greatest extent possible.
Exactly. Yeah. And I couldn't help but wonder maybe if that passage has some relevance to the way that we're conversing about this in America right now. And that's not to say, you know, that we can't think about personal liberty, but I wonder if there are moments like this that could actually expose in ways within which American Christianity has adopted values that sometimes conflict with the gospel, meaning that solidarity doesn't seem to entirely be on our horizon. And yet that seems to be a pretty core aspect of parts of the gospel. What do you think about that? It's just something I've been reflecting on. And I don't mean to be dismissive to people who are concerned with America maybe losing personal liberties. I mean, it is at a core value of American identity. But at the same time, I kind of wonder if that has moved in a direction that's been unhelpful in terms of the way that we think of the gospel from a Christian vantage point.
I mean, I think there would be dangers in a society that pushed total solidarity as well. I mean, total solidarity can go pretty easy into a very socialistic or communistic mindset.
But you can give yourself over to an authoritarian regime, right?
If it's, yeah, as long as we're all doing it together, total liberty can end up resulting in anarchism as long as I'm acting in full liberty and what's best for me. So I think most of us live somewhere in the spectrum in between the two poles and have to try to find where we fall in the balance in that. From my time in central Minnesota, some of the most warm-hearted, self-sacrificing, giving people who were all about helping their neighbors and serving other people. I think there, though, it was when the option was given to them. And so I think sometimes what I see in the American reaction is they're against it because they were told to do it. Whereas if it would have been maybe presented differently, there may have been a lot more volunteering to it. And so I think there's some rebellious part in our spirit, in our hearts, that says, you can't tell me how to be nice and care for other people. But then that contrasts from a gospel point of view with what does it mean to really submit ourselves to a master, a heavenly father, and the impositions that he puts on us, that he tells us how we should love one another and treat one another well, how we should treat the hungry, visit those in prison. How do we live in submission to his rules? And then also the commands to submit to the earthly authorities over us. And so there are gospel conflicts that take place in that. But I think it's in part as we try to figure out, where do I fall on this spectrum between we're all in this together and I have my own rights.
Mm-hmm. So I feel like we're heading inexorably toward this conversation on Romans 13, which we've been doing for a few weeks.
Yeah, you know, part of it is I think Romans 13 has been used to form this sort of foundation of a view of the relationship between church and state. Even one commentator that I use in my Romans class suggests that it has been pretty much the passage that's used to say, how should Christians think about the government and think about the ways within which the church relates to the government, which is interesting because the passage most definitely seems to, on a straightforward level, point to the fact that it's a Christian's responsibility to submit to governing authorities and to view them as servants of God for our good.
And this was used recently, like by Jeff Sessions, with the whole, was this maybe two summers ago with the
immigration?
Right, immigration. Yep.
Yeah, so some of it is, it has been used in ways to say, look, the government's going to make rules that you don't like, but you know, follow them anyways because the Bible says so. And so it can be used in those interesting ways. But there have also been people who recently have said, you know, some of this viewpoint about Romans kind of just telling Christians to acquiesce to the powers that be isn't quite right, and that there's actually subtle things going on in the passage that could reflect it as actually putting governing authorities in their proper place in God's big economy. so it's been interesting to try to think through and navigate, you know, a Christian perspective on submission to the government, as well as a Christian perspective on maybe subtle critique of the government, putting the government in its place in light of these different readings of Romans 13. I'm not sure that I've heard, Stephen, have you? I'm not sure I've heard many people who've been bringing Romans 13 into this conversation in particular.
No, and I think because it's so polarized, which governing authorities are you submitting yourself to, right?
Like, exactly.
You are leaning more Republican, then you would use it that way. But then if you're in a state with a Democratic governor, you would not want to apply it, right? So there's, and vice versa. You know, there's this tension about how we actually would apply that. So Mike, a couple of weeks ago, or maybe it's a month ago, you asked about this. One of the things that you said is, in a democracy or republic, you know, don't we believe that we as citizens are the ultimate authorities? Which I think changes the way that we would interpret that. Even the straightforward reading of Romans 13 of, you know, submit yourself to the governing authorities in a democracy, is that us or is that the elected official? What was kind of driving that thought as you put that out there?
It's been a hot several weeks on Facebook for me.
It seemed like that one was kind of a lightning rod, wasn't it?
And I think part of it is, it stems from me serving in church situations with people that really lived in both political parties and often struggled with how do I reconcile this when the people who sit across the communion table from me have very different political views. And often those political views, even 8 years ago, began to be divisive to the point where it was hard sometimes for people to know, is this person from another political party really a Christian? Mm-hmm. The same way I'm a Christian. And then to experience the mudslinging approach to elections that seems to take place in the last several cycles, to the point where you get to a position where someone's put in office where everybody knows all the bad things about them. And then whether it's to tell the people from the other aisle to get in line and look, this is the person that is now the person in authority, or what I felt was to some extent saying we didn't have any good options in the last election. From some of my friends saying, we just didn't really feel we had any good options. And so this must have been the person that God wanted to serve. This must have been God's choice for the leader of our country. And as another election cycle begins to ramp its way up, even seeing people saying, hey, we don't really have any choices. This must be God's appointed leader. And we don't live in a system anymore where we live 40 years under a kingship of one person, or where God sends in a conquering king and says, hey, this is my will for you. This is the leader that I've appointed for this time. We live in a system where we view ourselves for good or for bad as the people who have a right to vote and select our own leaders. So the question for me was, at what time does my self-governance, which I see as this inalienable right that God has given me, then be appropriated? When is that appropriated or given over to another person? At what point do I take responsibility for the appointing of that leader? And then also the responsibility for the goods and the bads. And then in light of a Christian relationship within the church, also not browbeating somebody who may have chosen something differently as being less Christian than me, or having to live with God's appointed person. At what point do we say, we made the best choice that we could with the information we had, and this is the person that I chose. Now how do we live with that without passing off responsibility to God?
Oh, like almost like deflecting responsibility then and saying, is that what you mean?
I mean, so certainly there's been some of that, at least in the circles that I've seen, where especially with the moral issues that we've been dealing with in the last couple of elections, where people say, well, yeah, but I mean, I had no good choice. This must be the person that God wanted. And so, so I'm deflecting the whatever moral compromises I may have had to make in the selection of this person by saying this was God's anointed person.
And then that has the implications, because you go on in your original post to talk about this question of what does it mean for us to hold authority accountable? Do we have the right, do we have the responsibility to hold authority accountable? And if I suppose that one of the risks is if we say, well, this is God's anointed, and there's kind of that idea from David, right, of not lifting a hand against God's anointed, which isn't a pretty particular context, right? But but there is this sense of like, well, if that person has the anointing from God, then I shouldn't say anything against them, or I shouldn't hold them accountable. That seems to be one of the themes that you were kind of looking at.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, so this came up again recently in a conversation I had with somebody. They asked me, well, what if King David was running for president right now? Could you vote for King David? Which is a really interesting question with all of his moral failures and shortcomings, but then also Psalm 51. You see this heart of pursuing God and the failures of the man. But my response back was, where do we fall as believers filled with the Holy Spirit, part of this priesthood of all believers in the realm? I mean, if you were to look at, okay, you have the king, where do we fall? Are we the people who just have the leaders pointed over us, or are we prophets and priests? And do the priests have a certain responsibility, regardless of who are rulers over them, to stand between the people and God and represent God to the people and bring the people before him in a special way? And do prophets have the moral responsibility, the biblical responsibility, to point out sin and to be critical of sinful behavior? And so what is our role as Christians? Is our Christians to just submit to the leaders that are over us without pointing out moral failures and moral flaws? Or are we called to be in some way uniquely apolitical, not necessarily standing behind any political party, but standing and calling out for the best of the land, for the best of the people, and pointing out sin? And the problem now is you can't point out sin without people putting it into a camp. If I point out the sin of one person, then I'm obviously pro-Republican. If I point out the sins of another person, then I'm obviously pro-Democrat. My question is, can we as Christians live in some way uniquely apolitical and say, regardless of who's leading us, we have to submit to their authority, but we have a different role, and we have a responsibility as well to serve as prophets and priests in the place that God has put us?
That's what I think is so interesting about Romans 13 in the conversation, because there's certainly Old Testament passages that point to God appointing leaders, and even God orchestrating and navigating leaders from the nations in the Old Testament to use for his purposes. And yet, the idea of God appointing the governing authorities, I think, is most strongly found in Romans 13. And yet, there's this fascinating disconnect between their context and ours. Ours meaning here even in the U.S., which is the concept of the people as it relates to electing governing authorities. That just is a foreign concept for Romans 13. And I think it's pretty clear that that the governing authority that Paul would have been referring to was likely Nero at that time. And clearly the Christians would have had no say. I mean, no one would have had a say in Nero being elected as the emperor. So that puts it in a fascinating context of the question of what do we do then as Christians when we are somewhat responsible for electing our governing leaders is something that Romans 13 can't entirely address. But what is a fascinating overlap is that what we're told are that we should submit to the governing authorities because they are God's servant for our good, because they don't punish a well-doing. They only punish wrongdoing. And basically then if you want to not be under fear of the governing authority, then do well. Of course, any Christian, I think, who may have read that could have thought that Paul was out of his mind, either terribly naive, even though it's very likely that the Nero that we're encountering at this time would have been a decent Nero. You tend to forget that Nero actually had at least 5 good years of rule where he probably wasn't doing insanely mad things. But even if that Nero is in power, the history of the Roman emperors at that point, which was fairly young, was still such that terrible injustices were constantly being carried out against people across the empire. So some people are like, well, Paul's out of his mind. He must be naive to think that these governing authorities only punish wrongdoing because they're doing unjust things. So where I think that's interesting is it provides us a little bit of encouragement to say, well, in situations where the governing authorities are acting improperly, there's still this sense of needing to recognize God's sovereignty in the midst of it. At the same time, since Romans 13 is assuming that actually the governing authorities are functioning properly in the sense that they're only punishing wrongdoing, not well-doing and whatnot, it may suggest that in situations that are different than that, the same rules don't apply. And so that's a fascinating potential overlap as well for Christians to think through in the modern world is if we think our governing authorities are acting in ways that don't fit the model that they're called to in Romans 13, are the stakes of the game different? And does that require a different response from us than just simple obedience? There's a lot there, I know, but it's a fascinating part to bring, I think, into the conversation and trying to apply that passage to our modern circumstances. There's some tension with it, and yet there's some promise as well.
It's not a situation that's untouched in the book of Acts, though, as the apostles found themselves under a Jewish authority that had been the religious authority for their lifetimes that was now asking them, commanding them not to preach the gospel publicly. And they did have responses to that. I mean, there are certain times where the biblical response seems to be, well, we must obey God rather than man. You could also go to Daniel, who refused to eat the food commanded by the king, or Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who refused to kneel. So there are incidents of resistance and demonstrable resistance to governing authorities when those commands strictly go against what we're called to do. The question is, for me, is when is that? And what is our role? Is the command to wear a mask from the government, is that a place where Christians, as an act of Christian resistance, should stand up and say, the government does not have my well-being in mind? Or is that a government command that Christians stand up against and say, this is a point of resistance for us?
I think one of the things that's really interesting to me is this idea you mentioned of, you know, somehow being apolitical. And of course, we see different ways that that's played out, you know, to kind of one extreme being maybe an Anabaptist tradition of, you know, a total pacifism of not even voting, you know, that kind of thing. So there's, you know, gradations of what that could look like. But I think one of the things that is disconcerting to me is the inconsistency of the Christian public voice around something like the application of Romans 13. Mm. So if we say, look, you're supposed to submit to the governing authorities when the political party we happen to favor is in power, and then we disregard that, you know, or downplay it or explain it away when the party that we don't agree with is in power, it feels like, okay, there's actually some other ethic at work here, right? This isn't actually the ethic of, you know, I want to apply good hermeneutics to my whole life, right? This is like, I mean, it just feels very convenient that there are worse words for it than that.
And Stephen, I think your point is interesting because some of the ways in the past that I think Christians have sometimes navigated that is, well, we resist when something that the scriptures say is challenged. But what's fascinating to me about, so the idea would be, right, that, well, regardless of whether our political party is in power or not, if we're being asked to do something that the scriptures forbid, or if we're prohibited from doing something that the scriptures encourage, then it's okay to resist. But what's interesting is, I don't know how wearing a mask at Costco fits into that entirely. right? It's a question I'm asking. I don't know if I have an answer, but does it really fit the model of the kind of forms of resistance that we've tended towards, even in the political context in the US from a Christian vantage point? Or are we kind of transcending that now and basically just getting down to personal preference or feelings of uncomfortability? I don't know the answer entirely, but I'm wondering that.
Mm-hmm. I think it's interesting too to think about that in light of the history of the church in Germany, you know, with the confessing church. And are there any examples that come to mind there of people wrestling with the question of submitting versus not?
Well, I think probably the most familiar example to that from an American perspective, looking at German theologians and philosophers, would be looking at Dietrich Bonhoeffer, of course, who, when Hitler appointed a bishop for the country of Germany that was very political in nature, and started mandating what the church should do, there was a group of Christians, this confessing church group, who said, hey, we need to really look at what is the statement of faith that we want to hold to, and who do we pledge allegiance to? Do we pledge allegiance to a country? Do we pledge allegiance to a political party? Or does our allegiance belong primarily and only to Christ? And do we confess Christ as this confessing church mindset? And so, yeah, there are absolutely moral and ethical issues that that Bonhoeffer had to wrestle through that maybe we wouldn't always agree with. Some would and some wouldn't. But I think the principle for him there was, how do I stay true to the scriptural principles and not necessarily submit to a government? And I think in this conversation, that is for me often the most concerning part of, and really what I mean when I talk about us being apolitical, not necessarily to be Anabaptist or Mennonite in nature where we don't vote at all, but to understand that once a person is in power, I owe them no allegiance from a political party point of view, that my allegiance belongs to Christ and my allegiance belongs to his bride. And I have responsibilities as a Christian that need to be followed regardless of what the party platform is. And I think there are plenty of examples, regardless if somebody leans more Democrat or more Republican, to be able to look across the aisle and say, there are certain parts of biblical values that other party seems to do better than the party I support the most does. And so how do we support the most biblical platform without feeling like we're betraying our Christian brothers and sisters or betraying our political party? And that's where I think from an apolitical point of view, we have to be almost a new confessing church and saying, what are the most important Christian values that we can hold up, that we can promote regardless of the political party in charge? And at times, and this is where I would say that passive resistance and demonstration against the government would come in times saying, we're going to do it even if the government doesn't. And I think the civil rights movement led by the church is one example of that, where Martin Luther King Jr. and others waded into the situation and said, this is not right. Even if it's the law of the land, it's not right. And those are incidents that I think we could point to even in our American history and say, the church needs to play a role in situations like that.
Mm-hmm. What's so fascinating to me about Bonhoeffer is I think a lot of Americans remember Bonhoeffer the resister. So they remember the Bonhoeffer who gave the speech, God is my Führer, you know, when Hitler came to power, and he was on German radio when it got cut off in the middle of his speech. They remember, you know, the Bonhoeffer who formed an illegal seminary in Finkenwalde, you know, and was training people for the confessing church illegally, and eventually it got shut down. And they remember the Bonhoeffer who helped to plot the assassination of Adolf Hitler. They don't necessarily, though, remember the Bonhoeffer who, and I think it was Eberhard Baetke, Bonhoeffer's close friend, who mentioned that they were like in a pub at one point, and they were all of a sudden, you know, the national anthem came over like an intercom, and everybody stood up and did a Heil Hitler, and Bonhoeffer stood up and did it too. And Baetke was looking at him like, are you out of your mind? And Bonhoeffer's like, we've got worse fish to fry here, like get up and give the Heil Hitler kind of thing. And it was like shocking to Baetke, but you get this tension in Bonhoeffer of on the one hand a deep resistor, on the other hand at times strategically acquiescing to aspects of the context. He worked for the German Abwehr. You know, there's that aspect too. He refused to perform, you know, the wedding of his sister and his brother-in-law because his brother-in-law was Jewish. And he even looked back in his letters and papers of prison with some deep regret on that, on not having performed that wedding. So you get this complex figure who in some ways is a great person to latch onto to say, you know, when the government goes poorly and when they're challenging our liberties, let's be a Bonhoeffer. But he's actually quite complicated because there are ways that he did give in, you might say, in ways to the government that aren't often acknowledged, I think, by a lot of American Christians.
We're all complicated, aren't we?
Exactly. Exactly. That's why he's one of my heroes. I mean, he really is, because I love that complexity in him. And I love that there are moments when, you know, I think if we're thinking about when in COVID should Christians stand up and say enough is enough in terms of government stepping in and taking away liberties, Bonhoeffer could be an important figure to point to. But I also like how complicated he was, because it reminds me, like, well, let's allow the complexities of our own conversation to exist and not try to just simplify it as some simple narrative that has an easy solution either. And I find that to be a beneficial part of the conversation, I think, even in the modern world here.
We have a tendency to really want to pursue our heroes and make people into heroes. And I think that's true throughout the Christian world as well. I mean, Martin Luther would be another one who, you know, we laud him for the stands that he took against the church that was in desperate need of reformation. And we remember his five solas, but his anti-Semitism and his siding with the princes and the peasants' rebellion is something that we kind of blend out of our hero worship. And so, yeah, I think that we need to give enough grace to one another and to our brothers and sisters to say, yeah, there's times where we're going to blow it, but also continue to expect the best from people and from our leaders as well. I mean, I think when a leader makes a bad decision, we could call that a bad decision without being mean, especially if those decisions are unbiblical. We can continue to point to biblical values and biblical truths.
Yeah, and to call something out and say that's wrong without diminishing the humanity of the leader.
I mean, I'm not so sure I could be a Nathan, walk in with a long bony finger and wag it in his face and say, you know, you are that man. But there are people who could be. And I think that we just need more, in my opinion, we need more people who are really willing to open up dialogue and let there be space for people from both sides to wrestle with what does the Bible really say about these issues. But I don't know that we get there much anymore. As soon as an outside voice comes in, people quickly box them up and put them in the camp in their mind that they must belong to, and then approach them with, I mean, a hater, a non-supporter, I mean, whatever label we put on people.
Well, we should probably let you get going here, huh?
Enjoy your day, guys.
Yeah,
you too. Thanks again.
Yep, very welcome.
Cool.
Talk to you later.
Yep, bye.
That was really fun talking with Mike.
I like his perspective, and I like he has this capacity, I think, you know, to think through some of the complexities of the issues in ways that are really fascinating, especially being an American in a European context right now. I think he brought a lot to the conversation in terms of just observations he's able to make in light of that. It was helpful.
I think the one of the things that I appreciate about his perspective also is that he very much does not want to be drawn into a perspective that isn't actually his.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, exactly.
The nuancing, I really respect.
And not wanting to be pinned into a certain political camp either, I think is good.
I think that this is a thing, right? Like what Mike was talking about with this idea of being apolitical and not necessarily saying don't be involved, but saying there is a deeper identity. There's a more true identity that if we are in Christ, right? It's that Philippians 3:20, our citizenship is in heaven. And we eagerly await a savior from there, right? That's my hope. That's where I'm looking and that's where I belong. And I think that the same kind of thing is true of, and I guess we were talking about this recently too, but that my rightness is not found in my ability to defend my rightness.
Yeah. And then you want to get deep into Bonhoeffer, right, who believe that he should become wrong or become, he might even need to do things that are ethically wrong for the sake of another person.
And that's something.
Like that is terribly complicated. You're a vicarious representative action where you're taking on sin like Jesus did. You're doing something that is ethically wrong. In his case, it was plotting the assassination and the murder of a human being. Where to him, he didn't justify it as, you know, guys, this the end justifies the means. For him, it was, what I'm doing is wrong, but I'm doing it as a sacrificial act for others who are suffering because of this individual. Mm-hmm. Now, we got to be careful. I don't want that to seep into too many political conversations. I think his situation was very unique. And whether he was right is of course, something that has to be reflected on. But
I do think this sense of our ethical reasoning, and I think that that's one of the things I appreciate that Mike brought up is, you know, here, I think sometimes I've heard American Christians dismiss Europe as being, well, because it's postmodern, you know, mm-hmm. and whatnot. It is therefore also unethical. And here you have, you know, German society saying, how do we reason ethically about something like testing for antibodies? Nice. You know, and I think that should be a challenge to us. How do we reason ethically? What is our ethical basis? And if it is just, this is my personal freedom, this is my personal liberty, it's not that that's unimportant. It's very important, right? It is a foundation of our society. But if we're in Christ, and you were going here earlier in the conversation, right? But if we're in Christ, there is something that matters more deeply and is more true that, if it's not informing our ethics, what's going on? Thank you for joining us for episode 9 of Professors in Rooms Getting Coffee. Our theme music is by Josiah Enns. Please remember to check out our sister podcast, Postulating Solutions with Preachers. We hope you can join us for coffee again next week.